I'm Bert Cohen, and it's time for Portside. Yes, we are living in the USA, as always, where it's all about money, isn't it? Hasn't it always been that way? Well, the economists will tell you, of course it's all about money. We're very rational beings. Everything can be predicted and controlled, right? Well, not so fast. There's been a lot of talk about the strength and weakness of certain economists in recent days and months as the recession has dragged on. And reacting to an article that, a really long article that Paul Krugman wrote, How Did Economists Get It So Wrong? Jane Smiley is our guest today. She is a frequent contributor to the Huffington Post. And her novel, A Thousand Acres, won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award in 1992. And she is on tour right now. We speak to her in Chicago. She's promoting her new book, The Georges and the Jewels. It's a 10-city national tour. And she wrote an article in Huffington Post called Other Economists in the Room. Thank you very much for being with us. Where did that title come from, Other Economists in the Room?
Well, the first thing I thought of when I was reading Krugman's piece was the little section, the third section about Marx. And so I was...
Oh, yes. There is so that that's economist. Why,
so he was another economist. But, you know, one of my favorite authors is Emile Zola. And if you've ever... and Zola's books were out of print for a long time in English, and the translations weren't very good until recently. But if you've ever read his books in his series of, I think it's 20 or 22 novels about the Parisian or the French Age of Excess, the Second Empire, it's like straight down the line. He knew exactly what was happening to us right now. So it's kind of amazing that... gosh, nobody ever paid a bit of attention.
The Age of Excess. Boy, that very few words, it seems to say a lot. Well, we are undergoing a major recession right now. I guess perhaps we've been pulled back from the brink of another Great Depression. But right now, 6 million Americans have lost their jobs. Unemployment is near 10%. And American households have seen $13 trillion in wealth evaporate. And
but I think it was fake wealth. You know,
well,
I think any wealth that is made by the financial community is really fake wealth. It's kind of agreed upon rising of prices. Real wealth to me is in what people produce. And so once they started exporting production to the edge of the industrialized world, then they started exporting the real wealth.
Well, it seems like there's part of capitalism per se, and I have yet to see the new movie Capitalism, A Love Story, but I certainly intend to, is kind of a timeless race for the bottom. You pay as little bit as you can. I mean, we had slavery for a while, but then you had to pay... local people did good work, produced good products, but the people who own the companies want to ship the jobs overseas where they can pay less and have fewer benefits to pay and relaxed environmental standards, if there are any. And
well, the only principle that they have is buy low, sell high.
Right. Buy low, sell high. Well,
and so they have to externalize as many costs as possible. And then that's how they get the buy low.
Yes.
And then they jack up the price. That's how they get the sell, you know, through advertising. That's how they get the sell high.
Well,
but
and
one of the bits of my piece
sure.
is about externals.
Yes.
And we pay for those. You know, the roads that I drove in on, the airport that I flew in on today, those were something owned by the general public. And yet we aren't given our fair amount to reimburse us for those because they keep their taxes offshore. That's the thing that really annoys me, too.
Well, you talk about that externals, and I think that's something that we really need to focus on. There's all these rationality and the great economists, well, I don't know how great, but they factor everything in except the externals. What are some of those externals that really are significant factors that you can think of?
Well, let's say that the Western oil companies want to access to the oil fields in Iraq. Then the Iraq war, paid for by yours and my tax dollars and our moral capital,
sure,
is an external, because they don't pay for that any more than we, you know, they pay for that if they pay for it as much as we do. But they don't factor that into the cost of the oil when they sell it. Now, obviously, the oil people are always telling us how much they spend looking for oil and how much they spend drilling for oil, et cetera, but however much they spend looking for it and drilling for it, they don't pay for the war that allowed them access, and they don't pay for the effects of global warming. We pay for that. And so that's, they don't factor that into the price of oil. If the oil companies had gone to war in Iraq and then put that cost into the price of oil, we wouldn't be able to afford any oil coming from the Middle East.
Yeah, it's true. And
it would, the price at the pump would be extremely high, and we would turn away from that and say, well, maybe we need to think of some other way to get around.
And I think about back in the early 60s when disposable soda bottles and cans came in. People, you know, the factor of disposing of them and the pollution that they would cause, I suppose that would be considered an external, because the companies that invested in it just made the money, sold the product, and that was that. We all had to pick up for those externals. I'm reminded of somebody, this show is coming from New Hampshire, there was a legislator who put in a proposed fee for disposable diapers, because you know when you buy them, everybody else has to pay for cleaning up the leftovers, shall we say, and the company that made it didn't pay anything. Those were externals, and I wonder how much of a factor those externals really are in the economy. And one thing I wanted to bring out, one of your lines in your article, other economists in the room, is you say that English majors understand human nature better than economists do. How how big of a problem is that economists are just sort of missing out on these externals and human nature?
Well, there's an implied idea in the idea of the free market, you know, adjusting itself, that is very Panglossian, you know, that somehow the free market will create the best world, the best of all possible worlds, when in fact we know that cannot be true, because people who are not restricted from doing certain things to earn money or to get rich quick will do them. Not everybody, but some people. And a clear example, I think, of that is the control of waste disposal in southern Italy around Naples. Those who control the business and life in Naples have no interest in waste disposal, and so the excess waste and pollution has become a very big problem in Naples. But the free market isn't operating. The people who control the economy in Naples aren't allowing, you know, they are fixing the market constantly to work against the people. So there is no free market there. And that's just writ large in the rest of the world. Those who have the money and the power fix things so that they won't lose money or power. So the idea that an economist would think that this system would be a good thing is bizarre beyond belief. And that's why I think that people who've read novels and books and have a more sophisticated, a marginally more sophisticated understanding of the way humans work, just think the free market is a ridiculous, ridiculous idea.
Yeah.
But, you know, the economists seem to have, you know, total faith in numbers and no real interest in psychology. Now, I know this is no longer the case so much because there is a sub-discipline of economics that is about the psychology of the market. But these people aren't the ones in power. These are people in the world of economics. The people in power in the world of economics are the descendants of the Chicago
yes.
School. Well, why are they in power? Because they serve as a kind of priesthood for the oligarchy. They tell the oligarchy that whatever they're doing is good. Everything will come out fine in the end. You can be as greedy as you want, and you are still a good person, and you can be unregulated and still get to heaven. When you look around yourself, and this is so self-evidently not true, that it's bizarre that they would pursue it. I mean, here I am in Chicago, the heart of the Chicago School. Didn't
right.
they ever go outside and look around?
It's amazing.
And see how politics works in Chicago and how things are built, streets are built and stuff like that. Please give me a break.
We are talking with author Jane Smiley, Pulitzer Prize winning novelist on a book tour and talking about other economists in the room. How did we get here? And what can we do, if anything? There's so much.
Well, here's one way that we got here.
Yes.
The decision or the argument and decision concerning the case of Santa Clara versus the Union Pacific, which is often cited as the origin of the idea that a corporation was a person. The redefinition of an entity, a commercial entity, as a person having similar rights to a person, a real person under the Constitution, but never dying, is one of the reasons that we got here. Now, there's plenty of the decision had nothing to do with corporate personhood. It was just one of the judges happened to make a few remarks ahead of time concerning corporate personhood. And this ballooned into this whole theory of how to make corporations enormously powerful and completely unregulated, even by the inevitable end that regulates people. And so I think that's one of the main reasons that we got here. But it's been an avalanche of decisions in favor of big business over the last, I think Santa Clara versus the Southern Pacific was about 1880 something,
yeah.
Maybe slightly earlier. So that's, you know, 125 or 130 years of a trickle and then an avalanche of decisions that award the wealthy and powerful more wealth and power. What astounded me, well, it didn't astound me, but it shocked me, I guess, was that Naomi Klein predicted in her book, The Shock Doctrine, that if there was a big economic shock in the U.S. or anywhere, the U.S. is an example of every place, that wealth would be funneled, even more wealth would be funneled upward into the hands of the wealthy, the bankers, etc. And lo and behold, a year ago, they threatened us with the collapse of the entire system. They came to us with their hat in their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? It ended in our money being funneled upward and people, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of people out of jobs, millions of people out of jobs, and everybody wondering, gee, what are we going to do about a jobless recovery?
Right.
I mean, Naomi told us what was going to happen. Everybody said, ooh-ah, and now everybody's scratching their heads as if they never heard a thing about it.
So many different parts of that. The rationality part of it. And when you talk about corporations and their legal personhood, that is a huge problem, which we haven't ever dealt with. It's been kind of swept under the rug, and yet they maintain their corporate personhood. And perhaps a corporate person, as opposed to a functioning human person who is born, lives, has some illnesses, and dies, as you say, a corporation doesn't die. And people, real human beings, are not necessarily led around by rationality. And it does seem that the assumption is made that a corporate person would be rational, and that the notion of rationality, specifically for corporate personhood, has been kind of leading economists around for many, many decades. Whereas you look at people, actual human beings, who are being hurt by this recession, people who are, you know, of moderate means, so often, frankly, are not rational in consideration of their own self-interest, for example, and vote for the corporate rulers all the time. They vote against their own self-interest and are not basing it on rationality. How central is the notion of rationality in, you know, what's led us to ignore the real reality that these are a bunch of humans out here who are consuming and making mistakes and not being rational? Your thoughts on that rationality as being central to how we got here?
Well, I think nobody but an economist would think that humans do act rationally in an economic sense. And everybody knows this except the economists. People buy things that they can't afford.
Right.
People are drawn to and they fail to pay for things that they can afford. They make all kinds of economic decisions that are irrational.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the economists feel that somehow all these irrational decisions will add up in the aggregate to a kind of overarching rationality.
Right.
But it's pretty clear from our experience of the last few, of the last, say, 8 to 10 years, that the corporations and the financiers have a kind of herd mentality. They make all kinds of decisions that are, in some cases, you could call it a kind of mass psychosis. But in any case, they get into a herd mentality. They all
yes.
run after the same thing that looks like a good deal or a good idea, and then they find themselves at some extreme end of rationality where it's going to cost a lot and take a lot of effort to change things. I mean, let's say that when U.S. companies decided to offshore all kinds of products,
right.
The manufacture of all kinds of products to China, what they were relying on was the idea that shipping those products back to the United States was forever, forever going to be cheap. Now, Does that seem likely, given the fact that we have known since at least the 70s that the oil supply was vulnerable and in danger? No, it doesn't seem likely. But it seems like they rushed to do this, thinking, oh, this is the way we're going to profit, make a short-term profit, and screw the long-term, you know, screw the atmosphere.
Yeah, yeah. Short-term, quick buck seems to have ruled for quite some time. But
there are legal reasons for that, too.
Go ahead.
You know, I mean, every time I wake up in the morning, there's some new article somewhere, it's often in the New York Times, about some regulation that was allowed to fall by the wayside that enhanced the idea that the short-term profit was good and the devil take the hindmost. I mean, today, yesterday in the New York Times, there was an article about the Simmons Mattress Company in Wisconsin and how it had been sold so many times by back and forth by private equity groups, always with a huge debt load that they borrowed in order to buy it and then imposed upon the company as its own debt rather than their debt. So they walked away with the profits, and the company was left struggling with this enormous debt. Well, that's called, as far as I know, buying on margin. That was what happened in the 1920s. And buying on margin was a very, very bad way to run the stock market. And so there were regulations against that. But when Ronald Reagan repealed regulations and put basically the fox in charge of the hen house, then of course all those old scams were going to come back. But the new generation of economists, Greenspan and Friedman and their friends, all said, oh, no, those things couldn't come back because the market will take care of itself. You know, well, the market in this case, in the Simmons mattress case, has decided that we don't actually need mattresses. What we really need is to funnel funds back and forth in private equity groups. Is that what we, the people, truly believe is what we need, to funnel funds back and forth from one rich person to another and for this excellent company to just go bankrupt, even though they continue to make an excellent product and they continue to be based in the United States and they continue to employ U.S. workers? Well, we might think that that's a good thing, that have that company like that, but the market, because of the deregulation, has decided against that. Well, what does the market think is good now? The market thinks is that the rich people get richer and everybody else gets screwed. That's what the market thinks.
We are talking on Portside with Pulitzer Prize winning novelist Jane Smiley, who writes regularly, frequent contributor for the Huffington Post, Bert Cohen here. And it does seem that a basic tenet, a mantra of the conservative economist has been to dismantle all regulations and safeguards with the faith that markets will solve all the problems. And the Simmons case is just, it's fascinating to me. You're right. It's always been known as a quality mattress. You know, it's an actual product that people have bought, employing thousands of people. And yet when it was twisted and turned into this just shifting paper back and forth, Thomas H. Lee Partners of Boston made a huge profit. They were the investment firm that bought Simmons in 2003. They pocketed around $77 million in profits, even though the company,
even though they didn't do a single thing.
Nothing.
With regard to mattresses.
I know. And here are these employees, the people who actually made the product, who worked hard, played by the rules, made a good product. They loved being part of the company because it was a good company. Then basically, as someone said, it's like squeezing all the juice out of the orange and there's just nothing left. So these employees, thousands of them are laid off and the economy gets worse. The recession gets worse. I'm reminded of some of the causes of the Dust Bowl in the beginning of the 1930s, when we just deplete and deplete and deplete and put nothing back in the land. Have we not learned from that? Is that, I mean, there's this whole rational idea, you know, sort of a worshiping rationality, like they worshipped logical positivism before the First World War took that one and destroyed it. And this is still going on. I wonder, are we learning from this stuff? Or what do you make of the Obama team specifically, their economic team? Are they recognizing this basic, essential, you know, root of the problem?
You know, I think the Obama team, I'm going to give them credit for being well-intentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that they have another way of looking at this besides the free market Chicago school way. I think they have been employed in this in the sorts of jobs. They've been successful through those kinds of ideas, and I don't think they really know what the alternatives are. And I think Geithner is too young, and I think Summers is too profoundly implicated, and I just don't know that they have the imagination or the set of intellectual tools to go very far away from economics as we've seen it in the last generation and generation and more. I mean, Paul Krugman, right, is not that terribly far outside of the mainstream. He's somewhat out of the mainstream. And, you know, he's won the Nobel Prize, and he's reduced to calling out from the bleachers. You know, admittedly, yeah, he's got a big bleacher at the New York Times, but they didn't invite him to be one of their insiders. He's reduced to being an outsider. So do they have a clue? I don't have any idea. I would like Obama to stand up and say, last year when I read The Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein, I decided to do things differently. But I haven't ever heard him say anything like that.
No, he does seem to be using a lot of the same people. And you earlier in the interview talked about the new priesthood of economists who, you know, tell the Wall Street people what they want to hear. And, you know, I wonder, is it individual economists who should be called to the carpet now for not seeing what's coming down and not having any idea how to get out of this? Or perhaps it's something more basic, like the relationship between the Chicago School of economists and academics and Wall Street. You know, that, and I wonder how, you know, are they simply telling Wall Street what they want to hear, continue to want to hear? And are there other economists besides Karl Marx out there who may have different ideas about, you know, what might be more sustainable, might actually fit in with human nature more than, you know, rationality?
I think there are other economists. Whether they can get their voice heard, I don't know. Economics, like any discipline, has a hierarchy, and people who are considered outside of that hierarchy don't publish in the prestigious journals, and so they don't get to they don't get their work seen. I'm not saying it can't change. I wonder, though, if it can change fast enough to prevent another big crash. And, you know, I think, you know, we don't know. Who knows? Are we back from the brink, or we just stepped over a little bit to the left on an even bigger brink? We don't know. The fog hasn't lifted.
Yeah, true. Well, Krugman uses, and I like his stuff generally most of the time, he uses John Maynard Keynes as a model. And wasn't Keynes really kind of successful in influencing the administration of Franklin Roosevelt when there was the Great Depression back then? Keynes' solution included government spending on needed public works, real involvement in the economy. Isn't, I mean, Keynes is, relatively mainstream economist. Isn't Keynes' model kind of exactly what we need now? More spending on public works, jobs, to build up the infrastructure and to give people jobs and to help really boost the economy, give people, working people, more money in their pockets so they can buy more stuff.
Well, I think it would be nice to think that, but I think the dangers are much bigger now because of globalization. And so the complexity of the economy is much greater, and the economy itself is much larger and much more geographically dispersed. And so I think assembling the whole world into a Keynesian model might be more difficult than anything that Roosevelt had to deal with in the 1930s. I mean, one of the things that Marx, I think, shows is that in some sense it works for the guy at the center of a particular place to keep shipping the jobs to the periphery as long as there's a periphery. And the guy at the center who keeps shipping the jobs to the periphery does this as a way of dealing with the constant rise of wages or the constant attempt on the part of the working class to achieve a balance. What happens when there, and I don't know that Marx could have envisioned this, what happens when there's no periphery? What happens when the entire world has become some oligarchs and some workers, a few oligarchs, a multitude of workers, and there's no one to buy the goods? What happens then? I think globalization has raised the stakes beyond where maybe we can control it. I don't know. As I said, I think we're still standing in the fog wondering where the actual precipice is.
Wow. This is all kinds of fun talking about this stuff here. You know, and I wonder about the idea of a free market. We have people who are still, and for years there's been a mantra of just let the free market reign. And there are people who absolutely believe in the free market. I don't know where the phrase came from. You may know, I don't, that the free market knows the cost of everything and the value of nothing. You know.
Well, here's a little sentence from my piece in the Huff that we're referring to. It says, if there is an unregulated free market, then everything must be for sale, including lives, children, bodily organs, endangered species, the air we breathe, and the planet Earth. The key thought here is that the free market puts all of these things up for sale, and quite often what the free market values little, such as the ozone layer or child sex workers, humans value very much. So, no, you cannot leave things to the free market, because, in my view, the free market leads directly, and often in a very short time, to a criminal society where only the powerful gain and where everybody else is at the constant mercy of others, because they're, whoever they are is worth very little. I have a friend who is kind of a thinker on these subjects, and he said, yeah, labor isn't worth much today. Well, what is labor? Labor is something that people do. So if labor isn't worth much and capital is worth a lot, then what he's saying is people aren't worth much. And if people aren't worth much, then anything can happen to them. Any number of crimes can be committed against them. And we'll just, according to the free market, turn away because they aren't worth much. Well, that's not how humans feel. That's not how humans feel. Humans feel that the people they know and love and are around are worth something, are worth loving or worth being attached to or worth caring for. So how can you put the two systems side by side, the system that says economically that the person I love is worthless or worth very little, And while socially and, let's say, personally, I feel that that person is worth very much. That's a recipe for tragedy. So is that where the free market is taking us? It looks that way to me. The free market is taking us toward a global tragedy.
And if I'm trying to follow that logically to the next step, that if people are not just objects, pawns in a game, if you will, in the free market, that, you know, there's the free market reigning over all of us, and we are just, you know, things to be used. And if we people are no longer useful to that great machine, that great free market, then our value is nothing. Well, we all know better than that we do have value as people. And it's incredibly ironic, really sickening, that there's this tremendous amount of money that is being siphoned from we the people to fewer and fewer people. I mean, the curve is just, it's unbelievable. The last 0.5% where all that money is, so that people, instead of being limited to the definition of workers or owners, talk about Marx here, that maybe we can be something else, that the people have creative potential. If people can have basic needs met, they don't have to be necessarily fitting in the machine of the owners or the workers, that they can do something else, like teaching is valuable, being artists is valuable, you know, contributing to human society. And yet, when the U.S. has been reduced to consumers, make more stuff, make, you know, and the owners make more profit, there's no way for that to fit in there. I wonder if, you know, we have this economic crisis that's hurting a lot of people. These are good people who are being tossed out of their jobs. The people who've worked at Simmons and worked there for, you know, a generation or more, they're good people and they're being hurt. They're just being tossed by the wayside because, well, the product they were making didn't really matter to the people who were just, you know, playing a shell game here and shifting all this money around. Wow. Interesting stuff here. I mean, one of the economists that I particularly liked is Robert Reich, and he has suggested that, you know, when the owners of the companies make all kinds of things, they ship it out to what's currently the periphery, and nobody's buying it anymore. He's suggesting that the government become the buyer and just buy all the stuff that's being made. But environmentalists might say, I would think, well, we kind of have enough junk already. I mean, you look at what Christmas has become. It's just making more junk, making more landfill and you know, having more stuff that we don't need. But that's the economy. The economy depends on making more widgets, whether or not we need them. I wonder how this can change, if you have any kind of analysis or suggestions that have a real change in what we believe here.
I don't know. I mean, I think the one possible salvation would be green technology.
Yes.
Which would transfer our consumption and our waste production to something more sustainable for the planet.
And that seems possible.
But we don't know if that's going to be the thing. The thing is, we don't know where we are on the curve. We don't know where we are on any of the curves. We don't know where we are on the population curve. We don't know where we are on the peak oil curve. We don't know where we are on the global warming curve. And the world is so complex that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to figure out where we are. So the best thing we can do is accept that we might have done ourselves in, but that for various reasons we need to use green technology as a way of stepping a little farther back from the precipice. Whether this is going to work, don't know. If you'd come to me in 1980 when I or when I wept at the inauguration or the election of Ronald Reagan,
yeah,
I would have said there's still a chance. That's 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So is there still a chance? Now we don't know. Now we're in uncharted waters.
And it was interesting. I'd say a lot of people would agree that it's very, very tragic how Glenn Beck basically put the pressure on Obama to fire Van Jones, who was heading up the whole green job.
I was crazy about Van Jones. Van Jones is a really, really smart, articulate, terrific, wonderful, completely intelligent, entrepreneurial,
yeah,
go-getter, energetic kind of guy.
Yeah.
I have never, one time I met him and I went up to him and I said, you know, as a baby boomer, I'm handing the world over to you because I think you can handle it.
Yeah.
And so I was really sorry that Glenn Beck managed to get rid of him. Not so much because I don't think Van Jones can go out and do plenty of good.
No, he will.
For the world, but because it's a symbol of what Glenn Beck is able to do and who he is able to skewer.
Yes.
When he, Glenn Beck, is a minuscule, small, tiny, little, vile human being.
How do you really feel? Well, I do.
And Van Jones is at the van. He's at the front. He's at the leading edge.
Yes.
And he is the opposite of Glenn Beck in every way.
And he tried to get something really done. He was part of his focus was on bringing green jobs to where people need jobs, the inner cities, places like that. I mean, take.
Yes, he has great ideas. I mean, he has the simplest ideas. Why haven't they been done before? You know, of people in inner city neighborhoods picking up the junk and doing something with it. That is the ultimate idea.
And years ago, Fred Harris was running for president, former senator from Oklahoma, and he said, you know, if you draw a picture of high unemployment and high crime, you're drawing the same picture, you're drawing the same map. And to address that by bringing new jobs in, the world, U.S. could be a world leader if we went on that path. And Van Jones was kicked out of there. And the Obama administration didn't stick up for him. They had hired him to be an environmental economic advisor, and then they caved in. And I'm a bit fearful about that. And, you know, as Robert Reich again says, that unemployment of this magnitude and duration translates into ugly politics, and that's what we saw there. There's fear and anxiety, and we've seen, you talk about human nature as a factor in the economy and in politics. The fear and anxiety are fertile grounds, as he said, for demagogues wielding the politics of resentment against immigrants, blacks. Van Jones happened to be black. I think that may have been a factor. The poor, government leaders, business leaders, Jews, and other easy targets. It's already started. It's already started. You know, the Tea Party people, the tea infusers, I guess they don't like being called tea baggers anymore. I don't really know why. But there's some hate out there. There's some real demagoguery out there, and this fear and anxiety is being used. They're being manipulated by the big insurance industries, for sure. But this fear and anxiety is real. You can't blame people for having fear and anxiety, and we've seen that used in the past, in the 1930s, in Germany. I wonder, you can understand how they're afraid and can be angry that their government, supposedly government of, by, and for the people, is being used for the plutocracy, government of, by, and for the very rich.
I don't wonder about the motivations of the right-wing populists, and their motivations are clear. You know, the people who are at the rallies and are rallying against change, their motivations are clear. I wonder about the motivations of the people in charge of the insurance companies and the banks. I mean, are they not human? Do they only define humanity as how much money you have or how popular you are or how dominant you are? Is that the only way they define? Because I'm friends with people in the racehorse business, I'm friends with people who know a few billionaires, that they aren't happy, the billionaires. It's not like they're reaching some sort of place of transcendent human joy. And so I don't understand their motivation at all. I don't understand how they can look around at the world that they more or less control and watch it go into the tank and not be horrified at who they are. And the only answer I guess I can come up with is that herd mentality, that inherent desire to compete. That's the thing that I wonder about.
Bert Cohen here on Portside. We're talking with author Jane Smiley, who is on a book tour right now and is a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. The book you won the Pulitzer Prize for is 1,000 Acres, and I believe that has to do with horses, does it not? Hello?
I can hardly hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You won the Pulitzer Prize for 1,000 Acres, and your new book that you're on tour for now is The Georges and the Jewels. Do both
yes.
those have to do with horses?
Well, 1,000 Acres didn't have anything to do with horses. I wrote a book called Horse Heaven, though, which was about horse racing, and I've written a couple of other books about horses. This book is about a little girl. I grew up reading horse books, and I loved them. And so this book is about a little girl who's in the 7th grade, and she helps her dad train the horses that he is subsequently going to sell to the local people in California. And it's really about being in 7th grade and also having a horse that you don't quite understand or get along with, and how you negotiate that and how you train that horse.
So it's not about the economy, but it's about
no.
human nature. Human nature, you know. Money is there, it seems to me, to be used to build things, to buy things, to whatever, to entertain ourselves, to buy art. And it's not just... You know, people are not there to be used by money. You would think money is there to be used by people. And, you know, Obama, I think, again, I certainly was a supporter and still am. And I think he's trying to recognize human nature, and that recognizing that left unchecked, Wall Street and the market and the insurance industry will just run roughshod over the rest of us and just all in eager worship of the almighty buck that's been around. That's part of human nature. But he's trying to change how people on Wall Street are compensated so that they don't have to take big risks that imperil the financial system. Is he trying to work with human nature and Wall Street to try to tone it down? Can it be done, do you think? Are we beyond that?
Well, like I said before, I have no idea. I have the feeling that Obama has what I would consider to be a rather rosy view of human nature. And people, when people look around themselves and say, this is what people are, really they're looking within. And, you know, everybody that I've ever known thinks Obama is a really well-meaning, nice, decent, good person.
Mm-hmm. Very smart.
And smart, you
yes.
know. So if Obama looks within, he sees goodness. I don't want him to look at those guys who sold the Simmons Mattress Company back and forth for profits and fees and see goodness. I don't want him to see goodness there. Because I don't think there is goodness there.
I want you ask if these economists ever do look within. Do they even have a within? Do they see? Do they care about the destruction they have caused? Or just does it not matter to them? I mean, have they gotten so wrapped up in this that they can't look within?
Well, you know, for the last couple of generations, economics has been based on a mathematical model. That does not that does not encourage you to look within. It encourages you to look at various factors and then factor them in.
Uh-huh. So if you get all the different factors involved, including the externals, and can measure everything, then, well, there were predictions not too long ago that there'll never be another Great Depression. We're safe from any kind of major recession. That there's that rationality there, but humans have a way of messing it up. And I suppose, you know, a nuclear power plant might be safe if you could factor in everything, but there is human error. There is the human factor, which can never be completely predicted. And it does still sound like, you know, is the market above humanity? Humans are serving the market, or maybe we need to factor in human nature into economic analysis and make it work more for humans than corporate persons, for example.
Well, I think the first way to do that is to remember that $1 does not equal one vote. That's what it's come down to in our world, is the more dollars you have, the more votes you get. And I think that's what the lobbying industry has accomplished. And so we need to go back to regulations. Can we make regulations? Can we have regulations that actually work? We don't know. But we need somebody who can look into the mind of a banker and see the nothingness that is there.
Hmm.
And bring that nothingness to task. You know, take that nothingness to task and say, you can't do what you want to do because what you want to do is destructive to others.
And that brings us to the conclusion of your article. You say what has created our mess is arrogant know-nothingism at the highest levels. And as long as that obtains, there is no hope for the rest of us. Could you say more about that? It's a little bit... you know, like a dark cloud over there, but can we make that change? Is it starting to change, do you think?
I don't know if it's starting to change. And, you know, I'm with Krugman in thinking that a false recovery is worse than no recovery at all. And a jobless recovery is a false recovery. We can't call it a recovery if people don't have any jobs. You can only call it a continued theft.
Interesting. And Benjamin Barber, who I interviewed on this, who wrote Consume, talked about, again, a false recovery. That you can make more stuff. You can sell more stuff. You can, you know, stimulate the economy so there's more junk made. But that's not really sustainable. That sort of sweeps the problem under the rug and keeps the... it's interesting how the Dow and the stock market have been going up. And there's sort of that recovery. It's closing in on 10,000. It'll probably hit it one of these days. But how real is that? How is it affecting people's lives? Is there any kind of sustainable, changed economy here that may really work? I mean, you talked about a green economy, that maybe that could be sustainable. But it's interesting to have this jobless recovery and have the Dow going up. And most people don't really participate in that recovery.
Well, the flaw of consumer capitalism is that it's consumer-oriented, and so more stuff has to be made. And you could make the case that the original powerful forms of American capitalism were about things like roads, railroads, bridges, infrastructure. And when those things were built, then the capitalist mind turned to other things that aren't really all that necessary. I mean, what makes me, I know we're running out of time, but what I remember as a child of the 50s is all the products on TV that were advertised that were food-like, you know, and the foods that maybe my mother and aunts grew up with in the 20s and 30s they had been perfectly nutritious. All you had to do was make sure that there was more of them. But in the 40s and 50s, those foods didn't have any real cachet or style. And so they made stuff like Ovaltine and Rice Krispies and you know,
margarine
that nobody, well, let's put it this way, no Frenchman in his right mind would ever eat. We were trained to eat them by watching television. So there was so you could say that the false boom began then, because it began with the idea that a food, something that is food-like, is really a food, and you need to eat it. Now, I speak as a big candy eater, but, you know, candy is candy. I don't mind a nice chocolate bar, but it's a chocolate bar as a chocolate bar. What I dislike is stuff like Tang that is fake orange juice.
But it's getting you to buy stuff. And that's, I think that it's interesting how, in certainly in France and other parts of Europe, it's not quite the same consumerism uber alles, you know? It's really not that way. It's about being human. Well, we have run out of time. Jane Smiley, novelist and essayist, won Pulitzer Prize for 1,000 Acres, and the new book is The Georges and the Jewels. I think I might pick that up. I have a seventh grader. But thank you so much for your insights into the humanness of the economy.
Oh, thanks. All right. Thanks for giving me a chance to rant. I don't often do that in person.
Well, we appreciate it. Hopefully it'll stimulate some thinking and maybe get us on some sort of new road to recovery. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And thanks for listening to Portside.
To touch her hat, she was mumbling in her sleep, and I listened close to everything she said. She was dreaming about the rocks and trees bleeding everywhere, and I wrote down every single thing she said. And she said,
the spirits of the earth are so hungry for justice, they cry. And the spirits of the sky,
by her house, she was gardening in the dark, singing to the green beans and the beets. She was wearing her high heels, chopping the high weeds, dealing out life and death. And I wrote down every single thing she said. And she said,
the spirits of the earth are so hungry for justice, they cry.
Every word she left.
justice, they cry. And the spirits of the sun